Welcome to the B-Movie Podcast, part of the Film Dispenser Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam Kautzer. My goal was simple. In less than 15 minutes, I will discuss a B-movie. A movie out of the normal big-budget blockbusters that have taken over most of what we watch in genre film today. So buckle up as I take a look at a supposed lesser or possibly forgotten film. Welcome back, everybody. New week, new double feature. The double feature is titled Marshalling On, where we're looking at two films by director Frank Marshall, who is better known as a producer because for probably the first, 25 plus years of his career, he was busy producing Steven Spielberg's films over at Amblin with his wife, Kathleen Kennedy. And of course, we all know what happened with Kathleen Kennedy, went off to bigger, better things within the Star Wars universe. But we're talking today about a film that is near and dear to my heart, Arachnophobia. This is actually my gateway drug into horror films. It's actually probably the first like horror movie that I saw that in the theater, and this movie worked like a motherfucker on me. I saw it actually, they had this preview of it like a couple of weeks before that you paid to go see it. Like back in the day, like back in the 90s, when they wanted to get word of mouth out about a good movie, they would have these Saturday night previews where you would pay to go see a movie a couple of weeks in advance. And their hope was that you would talk about the movie, tell how good it was, to kind of spread the word that this maybe smaller or different, unique movie was like, you know, a legitimately great movie. They actually did this the same year in 1990. They did that with Ghost, and I do distinctly remember seeing Ghost at like a preview. And yeah, I mean, they're both films that, I mean, you know, Ghost is Ghost. I mean, it's Patrick Swayze's biggest movie. It was a huge movie in that year, and just kind of set him and Demi Moore off into like a superstar trajectory. But we're not here to talk about Ghost. We're here to talk about Arachnophobia, which it did decently. I mean, you know, by far and large, I mean, it made about $50 million in 1990 money, which is like, you know, equates to about $100 million. Not bad for a horror comedy. This movie, like I was saying, really worked on me. I still have very vivid memories of this movie. When we went to go see it, it was my mom, me, and my sister. Now, why my mother would take a six-year-old child to go see this fucking movie, I have no idea. But she still did, and I still distinctly remember my sister being so upset about this movie and everything that was happening in it within the first 5 minutes that she fucking, like, my mom had to fucking leave with her and go see a different movie. I can't remember what they watched. But I stuck it out. I watched it, and I remember, like, what I remember distinctly about the experience was how slowly but surely the temperature rose in the theater. It's still like one of those, I think that everybody has one of those horror movies, that gateway drug that leads you to a bigger, like, you know, the bigger world of horror. And that's what Arachnophobia did for me. I know it sounds weird. I mean, most people will say their gateway drug of choice, or their gateway drug for horror, was something like Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2, you know, Army of Darkness. No, wasn't that. For me, it was Arachnophobia. And it's because, like, for me, and I love this particular genre, even though it is a slight and small genre, is the horror comedy. When it's done right, it is one of the most effective genres, crowd-pleasing genres that there is. And I feel like this one works, and it works like gangbusters. I mean, I was watching it, rewatched it a few times for the podcast, and I had forgotten how utterly charming the movie is and how many jump scares there are. And this movie is one of the first movies that was released under the Hollywood Pictures banner. Now, anybody that is a B-movie fan knows,
you know, Hollywood Pictures, which is the quote unquote adult wing of Disney, when they wanted to make, like in the 90s, they wanted to start making more mature content. So what they did was they opened up two wings. I mean, they already had had Touchstone Pictures, which was kind of, it kind of dabbled in that. I mean, they were in the Scorsese business, if you could believe that, in the 80s. And they slowly kind of shifted over to this Hollywood Pictures. Now, what I love about Hollywood Pictures is that along with a lot of, shall we say, interesting movies and decent movies, a la like one of the last things that they had produced was the Simpson and Bruckheimer classic. I mean, it is a classic, Crimson Tide. That was one of the last things before they closed the shingle down, because there was just so much like shit that they produced. But I mean, really interesting shit, like Billy Bathgate. I mean, that's a movie that I've come to really like, with an interesting David Mamet script that people just outright hated during that time. Neil Simon's The Marrying Man, a notorious movie that I feel like it doesn't work in huge swaths, but there are sections of it where you can get the intent. And of course, we covered early in the pod, not really early in the podcast, but during our October month, we covered one of my favorites, the deep fried classic that is, you guessed it, Deep Rising. And then also additionally, the 13th Warrior was supposed to be a Hollywood Pictures, but then that, again, it got shut down and got transferred over to Touchstone Pictures. And it's all to say that I really, whenever I still remember any time I saw a Hollywood Pictures logo, it, even as a kid, it put a smile on my face, because it was either going to be something special, and if it wasn't and it crashed and burned, it was still going to be interesting. This was one of the first films that was released under that shingle, and thank God for it, because I think that this movie gets away with a lot more than anything from anything that Disney would produce that would be a horror comedy nowadays. The ratio of horror to comedy, like, everybody thinks that there's some kind of formula, which it really isn't. It just depends on the picture. Like, for me, this has, for this movie, has the perfect ratio. It's like a 65-35. 65 scary, 35 funny. It kind of mirrors, in a weird respect, American Werewolf in London, which I feel has the same kind of funny joke, like jokes to horror ratio, about a 65-35, which is not necessarily the, how shall we say, the magic formula, but I feel like you need more horror than comedy in order to make it work. Now, there's a random there are a few random outliers out there, which specifically there's only two, actually. Ghostbusters and Army of Darkness. Both have more comedy than horror, but when they need to be, they can be effective horror movies. So with that, I mean, I guess I might say that there is a formula, at least for me, and it's that, like I said, 65-35, or a little over more than half of the movie has to be horror-based for me in order for it to work. So, like, the comedy is like a pop for me, which it does here. This movie is, I mean, if you've not seen it, it's kind of part kind of Michael Crichton, like science gone wrong on the loose, fucking with nature, slash, you know, horror film, a horror monster movie, basically a South American killer spider, makes its way to Northern California and wreaks havoc on a town. And the town, it's interesting because this movie is like a Frank Capra, Preston Sturges movie meets meets a Universal Monster movie. I mean, it's really kind of, it's an interesting kind of melding bastardization of genres, but it works. Jeff Daniels plays this new doctor in this northern, this quaint small Northern California town, and he goes there, and you know, the setup is straight out of a Capra film. He's the new young hotshot doctor that comes in from San Francisco, and he quickly realizes what a big mistake this is, because he's found that the doctor, the older doctor, who's a complete asshole, has decided not to retire. And so basically, Daniel's character, Ross Jennings, is up shit creek. He's moved his family. The Jennings, who the mother is played by the great Harley Jane Kozaks, who was the mother in Parenthood. And I will be honest with you, she's the mother in Parenthood, not Mary Steenburgen, but Rick Moranis's character's wife, the one that he sings the song to towards the end of the movie. And she's great playing against Jeff Daniels. But what's great is that instead of having like this, essentially a Frank Capra setup with this whole thing of like, you would think that the doctors are going to go to war. There's going to be some kind of like, and by war, I mean like, you know, a small battle of wits, and the town is populated with colorful characters like the sheriff, who's an idiot, a bully idiot, the doctor, the crazy bug exterminator played by John Goodman, which we'll get to in a moment, but it's all for naught, because the spider actually ends up being transported to this town and just wreaks a bunch of havoc. What I love about the opening is that the opening begins in it's the Venezuelan rainforest, where we are introduced to a photojournalist who's going to see Dr. Atherton, who's played by the great, great Julian Sands, in one of those roles. Like, I love movies with Julian Sands. He was this guy in the 90s that was just great. This English guy who always got he was like the B movie equivalent to Alan Rickman. Like, where Alan Rickman was doing the bad guy British thing in the A-list movies, Julian Sands a lot of times was doing those lower budget B movies where he could play the bad guy. I am thinking of one of my deep fried classics, or my deep fried favorite classics, Warlock and Warlock 2. If you've never seen those movies, I cannot wait for you guys to watch those. Those are actually on the list. But he's great. Fucking Julian Sands, and he plays the kind of arrogant doctor to a T. It's almost like he's playing a cliche of a Michael Crichton character. And the photojournalist comes to see him and to basically, like, you know, document what they're doing there. And they go into this sinkhole, and it's like great, great, like atmospheric scenes where they're hiking down into this sinkhole, this like 1,000-foot drop, and they start to show the photojournalists what they're doing, which is they're fogging up the place so that like insects can fall to the ground, and they can pick them up to study them, because there's, like, as Julian Sands says, there are species that have never been recorded in history in the Amazon rainforest. So of course, with this kind of setup and this kind of Crichton-esque story, of course there's going to be a killer spider, and of course it's going to find a way to get into this photojournalist's tent and go ahead and bite him and instantly kill him. There's always like these really clever touches on how is explained how the spider actually gets to Northern California. And if you've never seen it, I won't ruin it with the plot minutia, but it is very interesting. What I love about this movie is how Marshall, and this is kind of interesting because it's very similar to what we'll talk about with Eight Below on next episode, is that with nature, he seems to have like this really like this thing about tracking the logic and actually giving the creature or animal its share of screen time. So these spiders become characters in this movie. Like, he shoots them like characters, very similar to the way that Eight Below, which I feel is like a really, really good film, does the same thing by tracking the animals. And he shoots the animals just like he shoots the spiders, in a very traditional way, with, you know, establishing shots, close-ups, tracking shots. It's not like he's using them in like just a scare fashion. He's building a logic and a character with these spiders so that we understand how deadly they are and like can see them as like actual adversaries to the humans. And that's something that's really great. I mean, he actually tracks it. It's like literal tracking of logic and how the actual spider gets there. Now, of course, some of the logic is fucking retarded, but I mean, you know, it's a movie about killer venomous spiders. So of course there's going to be some wonky shit, but it's great. And it works in a really pulpy Michael Crichton way. And the great thing is that the way that he balances that whole Capra and Crichton thing is that because of the fact that it's styled like a Frank Capra film, we get a lot of great character moments. And so when things start hitting the fan and people start dying, they really mean something to you. And it's like those tension moments where, you know, people are like, you know, we're tracking the spider and the spider is getting closer and closer and closer to somebody and they just miss it or they end up getting bit. And there's tension, there's true tension, because Marshall understands with this script that's by Don Jacoby and Wesley Strick, both who respectively are, you know, like really, really prolific screenwriters, and both of them doing a lot of B-movie work. We actually talked about a Don Jacoby film a while back, also in October. We looked at his screen, or he we looked at his film that was directed by the great, come on, guys, you know, John Carpenter. He wrote the script for Vampires, which is another great movie that you should see. But what I love about the movie is that they allow for those characters so that we literally care about what happens to them. And it's just a great, it's a great combination. I remember when I was a kid, I felt like Marshall was making a Steven Spielberg film, which now watching it with close to 25 plus years removed, he hasn't. He's actually making a Frank Marshall film, which I feel is completely defined by this movie. Like, it's a genre film, but it's a genre film based on like adventure nature style conventions. Like the whole thing of like the spider coming, like the venomous spider. I mean, later, like just 3 years later, he would make his great, great, great adventure drama Alive, which is you know, about a plane crash. Yes, of course, it's about human beings being eaten and trying to survive, but I personally feel that that movie gets a lot of shit because of the whole cannibal aspect of it, but it's a great fucking survival film, and that crash scene may be one of the best crash scenes ever filmed. Yes, and by the way, Green Inferno, no. You're good, but Alive came first, and I feel is still more effective. But just little side note there. But I feel like Marshall has his own voice. He really does, and I really like his voice. I love the adventure aspect of his films. Like when you watch 8 Below, or you even watch Arachnophobia, you almost wonder if this guy, if he had been born, like, say, 40 years before, he would have been making, like, adventure films. Like, adventure films, like, as in, like, the way that, like, you know, John Huston made The African Queen. Or the way that Howard Hawks made Hatari. Like, that's how I feel, like, there's, like, this whole sense of nature and adventure and genre within Frank Marshall that I don't feel is there for Spielberg. I think that Spielberg makes his own style adventure films, but they're never kind of that Kipling style, like, influence. It's not there. Like, he has different, completely different influences. And it's a great little fucking film. You've got this, like, you know, of course, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but I fucking love Jeff Daniels. Like, Jeff Daniels is also a thing for me. Me and Scott, a writer at Film Dispenser, had a podcast, a very short-lived podcast called Deep Cuts, and we covered something wild, which was like the first Jeff Daniels movie that I ever saw when I was a kid. I think I saw it in like 89. It was like 11 years old, and that movie blew me away. And since then, I've been a Jeff Daniels fan. I always feel like Dumb and Dumber, though it made him a ton of money and got him on the radar with people, it kind of fucked his career, because you watch everything that he does for like 10 years after that, and it's great fucking work, but nobody is thinking about it because they're thinking about him being Harry or Lloyd, whichever one he plays in Dumb and Dumber. And, I mean, like I said, great money for him, but it just kind of fucked him over on his career, because the career that he's having now, that resurgence that he's having in some really great, awesome supporting roles, he really, like, he didn't get those roles in major pictures because of that Dumb and Dumber role, which, hey, you know what? I mean, made him money, but then again, I feel like it came at a cost because nobody ever respected him. But here, he's great. Like, he's great as this like, you know, this like Capra-esque lead. I mean, he's a doctor, he's a dad, he's a husband, and he's and he's just really good, affable, charming, like, Hanksian-style role. Like, you could see at this moment, like, when you watch him, you go, fuck, this is, like, you know, he's, with three different roles, he's fucking Tom Hanks. I mean, that's literally what you see when you see this movie. You know? But John Goodman is good in this. I mean, John Goodman steals the show. Like, I'm a huge, huge, huge John Goodman fan. And here, it was like his role as Dilbert McClintock is designed for kids. It's literally designed for guys that are between the ages of like 8 to 14. Like, nowadays, I'm pretty sure that they would get Josh Gad to be in this role. Pretty sure, because it's like that kind of goofy but charming and affable kind of role. The role, like, essentially that John Goodman has always killed at, that affable, charming guy that, you know, is just you want to, like, whenever I see Goodman in this movie or in any movie with the exception of a couple of films, I just want to, I want to give him a big bear hug. Like, I just want to fucking, like, give him a hug because he's, like, a great guy. And here, it's just so fucking awesome. Like, everything that he does is just, it comes from a different place. I mean, you know, he knows that he's stealing scenes. Like, I feel like this and Walter from The Big Lebowski are his, like showboating roles. You can't get better than these two roles for like a Goodman showcase. And he just plays it to the nth degree. This bug, this like, you know, bug exterminator slash, you know, cowboy jockey, that just has like bravado to spare. Really interesting fact. It's been about probably like 10 years since I've seen this film, and I always forget that he survives the film. Like, I honestly thought, like, I could have sworn that when I initially saw the film that he died. But, you know, like, I'm always pleasantly surprised that he survives the film. It's actually Julian Sands that dies a horrible fucking death. But I just have a lot of love for this film. It's a really great, fun ride. I think that it's acceptable for children. I think that this particular podcast, I didn't mention at the beginning, but these movies are, like, you know, they're PG-13. One's PG-13 and one's PG. But they're kind of family films. And in a way, I kind of love that. And family in the way that say, a Spielberg Amblin film, which this is where anybody can go watch it. You know, I think that this is like an Amblin film that people have forgotten that they really need to rediscover. And if your kids are leaning towards like horror in any kind of way, and they're younger and they kind of have an interest for it, show them this movie. I think they'll trip and flip for this one because it's fun. It's a lot of fun and it's a little cheesy, but it's good. There is a Blu-ray out of it. I mean, of course, that's what I watched it on. It was it's got a couple of special features, like these featurettes that talk about Frank Marshall directing the Venezuela scene, and then just the production as a whole. Maybe about 15 minutes worth of stuff. They could have very easily not included anything, but they did, and it was great. I had the Blu-ray or the DVD initially, which was a non-anamorphic Blu-ray or DVD, which, you know, I mean, at a certain point, you know, it's like, it's kind of horrible stuff, but this Blu-ray, you know, it's got a nice transfer. It's not the best transfer, but it definitely does the job and got a great soundtrack, which any horror movie needs is a good active soundtrack, and it definitely does. So check this one out. You can reach out to us on the Twitter and Instagram handle. They're both the same thing, BMoviePod, the letter B, the word movie, and the word pod, all together, no lines, no dashes, no bullshit. We have some written content out there. The B-Movie Isle, our written component is, I'm not going to lie, I'm going to be self-promoting. It's kicking fucking ass. We've got a lot of shit out there. We posted something about the Screen Factory or the Shout Select release of Colors. You're going to see something from the Red Dawn disc. Should be posting fairly shortly. And then in the coming weeks, you're also going to see something about RoboCop 2 and 3 from Shout Factory, and then which we already covered on the podcast, but now we're going to get the written content where you're going to be able to read about the special features. And I'm telling you guys, those discs are fucking stacked. And then I was posting this week, sometime this week, I have my thoughts on my first viewing of Cinema Paradiso. Never seen the movie before. Can you believe that? A 30-year-old foreign film classic that like it's just a cinematic blind spot. But I get into that in the actual article itself. But there's a review up of that. And Arrow Academy killed with that fucking release. So read that. Just to say, we have a lot of shit going on the B-Movie Isle and the B-Movie Podcast. So we'll be back next time with Frank Marshall's directorial effort entitled 8 Below. which, if you've never seen this movie, this is a movie that's near and dear to my heart. So much so, every time I watch it, I get choked up. Like, you know, but we'll talk more about that on the next episode. So until next time.